But it's honestly a spray and pray game. It's an A-B testing game. It's a try a lot of things, do what works, stop what isn't, and then keep experimenting on the side because this is going to stop working soon.
I'm Jim Huffman, and this is If I Was Starting Today, a collection of conversations about half-baked startup ideas, growth tactics, and stories from founders, including my own journey as a business owner. All of the content is centered around one question. What would you do if you were starting today? Welcome, welcome to If I Was Starting Today. Yep, the podcast where we dive deep into the beginnings, the gritty, middle, and the success stories of those who have quote-unquote made it. I'm your host, Jim Huffman, and today we're unpacking the journey of entrepreneurship, resilience, and the art of making it big, selling barbecue online. In this episode, I have the pleasure of sitting down with New York's only Andrew Bueller, the visionary CEO behind Urban Smokehouse. They sell ribs, barbecue pork, barbecue chicken online, and it's amazing. So we're going to explore a wide range of topics, from how this guy, he launched a company without a product, without a website on Kickstarter, and did over $25,000 in the first day. And he tells us exactly how he did it. He shares invaluable advice and tactics on resilience, the importance of putting yourself out there and talking to people that have done it before, and then how he skyrocketed Urban Smokehouse from doing $30,000 a month to, wait for it, $250,000 per month in under 2 years. And all of this is on the back of one channel, Meta and Facebook ads. He gives us the blueprint of how he makes content that actually converts for ads and how he does it in a scalable way with two video sessions per month. And all of it's funneling through his one-person Shopify website. So for anyone daydreaming of turning your one-person company into a seven-figure success story in under 24 months, this episode might be for you. It's packed with insights and advice that you don't want to miss out on. So whether you're in the car, you're on a jog, or you're just taking a break, tune in and let's get inspired together. I really hope you enjoy today's episode with Andrew. I found myself writing down notes as well with things that I want to do. So let me know what you think. All right, so Andrew, you have a company that has grown quite well, but it started without a product or anything, and you just validated an idea, I believe. Tell me more about that.
Sure. So I did something called a crowdfunding campaign. I did a Kickstarter campaign. And essentially what that is where you put an idea on the internet. So I made a video explaining kind of what I wanted to build and how I was going to deliver that product, which was pre-cooked barbecue foods that would come in a styrofoam cooler with packages of dry ice that you could order from my website, and it'd be delivered to you within a couple of business days. And while pitching that in the video, you're able to collect essentially IOUs or pre-orders from customers. Some people bought t-shirts, some people bought the actual product, some people bought products for friends, some people asked me to fly out and cook them ribs, but they did different versions of supporting this idea and this brand. And I had a goal. The goal on the Kickstarter was to raise $25,000. You have to do that within 30 days. We did that in 24 hours, which was tremendous.
Wow.
And then ended up, you know, going above and beyond our goal in the next 29 days of that campaign. And then ultimately was able to do the goal. And the reason crowdfunding is so interesting is because you don't have to invest in inventory, equipment, personnel. You can really put a small amount of dollars to work in making essentially a short video or a short value prop of you explaining what you want to do, and then get a tremendous amount of money after explaining that to the public. And that de-risks your idea of launching this product or the service, because you now have money to pay to buy the inventory, to make the inventory, to build the products, to hire people, to execute the idea. And so I think crowdfunding is often overlooked, but can be a really powerful tool, and it helped me dramatically de-risk and initially validate the product, because I was able to find hundreds of people that wanted to buy the product, were willing to pay for the product, that seeing it or trying it.
That's amazing. I have a friend, Craig Swanson, who's launched a bunch of things and sold things, and he has this framework of sell, launch, build. And I think it's something that you did phenomenally well, But you make it sound so easy. Like, yeah, you know, throw up a video, put it out there, and then boom, I got 25K in 24 hours. And I'm sure there was a lot of thought that went into it, because a lot of people listening are probably thinking, okay, how do I do that? Could you give us more color or break down the pre-launch strategy that went into your crowdfunding campaign? What all went into making sure this would be a success?
Sure, a couple things. So the first thing I did is I reached out to people that were some of the most successful on Kickstarter and Indiegogo, which are the two big crowdfunding platforms in the food and beverage category specifically. So I reached out to people that were part of a company called Flyby Jing, which is like a Chinese Sichuan chili oil hot sauce. Reached out to people that were part of a company called ButcherBox, which is a meat subscription box. And I reached out to a couple of people that actually weren't in food and bev, but, you know, just were big on Kickstarter as well. And I said, hey, you raised 10x your goal. You raised 30x your goal. Like, how'd you do that? So always find people and ask them questions how they did it and hope for an ounce of their success. And pretty much all of them said the same thing, which was, hey, the Kickstarter algorithm highly favors people that like dominate their goal. So if your actual goal is like 30,000, set your goal on Kickstarter to be like 10 grand so that you can hit the goal early and have the hopes of being one of the products that's featured on their homepage or in the categories homepage, because there's categories, you know, software, food and beverage, art. So if you can be like one of the trending or hot projects in any of the categories, that will help you get more random people to support your project because there's just more visibility on it. And so I set the $25,000 goal I felt was modest for what I actually wanted to do. And I was confident that I could garnish enough interest to hit it pretty quickly. And so then, in addition to that, I made a splash page, which is basically a website where you just ask for people's email addresses and you like vaguely describe what's happening, but there's no additional pages to the website. It's a box that's like, give me your email and maybe a brief video or brief description of what you're doing. And it says like coming soon, you know, stay in tune here. So you build a splash page that you can do that very economical. It's you know, probably $100 most if you don't even have the website built.
Do you remember what tool or website builder you used for that?
I unfortunately don't, because it was very temporary, but everything I have now is built on Shopify, but I'm sure if you Google around, it'll be easy. I hired a bunch of people on Fiverr initially. So like everything I didn't know how to do, I was paying people, you know, $5 to $10 an hour, very modest.
Good for you. That's awesome.
To get things done. Because I do not have a tech background. The whole website development thing was new to me. And then lastly, it's extremely important, like, you tap your network and you raise your hand for help. This is the one time where you need to be like super annoying, ask everyone 10 times. And similar to if they're not going to support the campaign themselves, try to have them find someone that will. Say like, hey, I'm building something. This is my idea. What do you think of it? Can you please support me? If not, do you know anyone else that likes barbecue food? Do you know anyone else that's looking for a new desk? Do you know anyone else that's whatever your idea is? Do you know anyone that likes this stuff? And can I talk to them? And so before even having the video where I'm then pitching the world or the public on this idea, I actually spent a month just calling everyone in my contact book, texting everyone in my contact book, emailing people and getting them on the splash page and also incentivizing them saying, hey, just so you know, I've talked to people that have been the most successful on these platforms. And if you want to support me, it means 10 times more to me if you do it in the first day. I know it's a 30-day campaign, but we're trying to beat the algorithm here. We're playing a game. And so if you can support me in any way, please do it the very first day. And then with the splash page, you now have all their contact information. So the first three days, you got to be annoying. You got to be like, it's happening in 3 days. It's happening in 2 days. It's happening in a day. It's happening in an hour. It's live. We've been live for an hour. We've been live for 2 hours. Annoy the hell out of people. Annoy the hell out of people. This is the one time you want to ask for the most help, because you only have your network to start. And 3 months, all these people are going to be nowhere. But hopefully they started that snowball effect. And now you have random people supporting the business. And so that's how I did it. That's kind of like the simple nature of, oh, and you asked what the budget was for the video. So I live in New York City. I like basically went around all the best New York City restaurant pages and saw who had like the best videographer, or what I'll call like food porn shots of their stuff. And I was like, who did this? Who did this? Who did this? And just found the most local, most cheap guy to come to my house and film on my roof. And all in, the entire video production, I think, was $1,200, but it looked super high quality. And I was really happy with the work. And I'd highly recommend him if you are in New York. But if not, I mean, there's great websites out there to find local talent, and you should invest in it, because it's the video is what's going to carry you on the Kickstarter.
Nice. And what about like the script of it? Were you just nerding out and looking at the top performing videos and taking notes from it? Or was there a certain formula? Because I'll put the Kickstarter link in as well. But in that, and you've been amazing at content even after that. But like, talk to me about the script.
The script, I kind of approached it like a high school essay. Like, there's an introduction, there's a conclusion, and in between you need to have, you know, different detailed paragraphs outlining different things. But you kind of say the elevator pitch, so figure out your 15 to 20 second pitch. You say that in the beginning, and then you say it reworded at the end, and in between you put all the meat on the bones. I rehearsed the thing probably 1,000 times. I mean, that's important as well too. So during that month where I was spam calling people, I had probably wrote the script 20 to 30 days before I did the video. And I would say it in the mirror all the time. I'd say it to people on the phone. I'd tweak it. I'd get feedback from those people. And it's good to get feedback from those people too, because they're the ones that are going to be getting pitched in 30 days regardless. So have them tweak it for you in advance. See what's going to hook them.
That's hilarious. And sorry, just to clarify, was the splash page, did you have that go up before the launch for crowdfunding to have their email list? That way, when you're ready to go, you
exactly.
can hit them
so,
up.
So given you want to kind of have an explosive start on these crowdfunding campaigns, as I mentioned, part of the trick for beating the algorithms or becoming one of the, you know, there's probably 10,000 live projects on any of these sites at any given time, but there's, you know, less than 10 on the homepage. How do you become one on the homepage? The main thing I heard, because I talked to all those people that had raised 10 or 20x their goal, they said you set a modest goal so that you can hit that goal quickly. And you need to, through your activated network, hit that goal in the first 24 hours. And so I had the splash page so that I could have everyone's contact information to remind them of the launch date, and on the launch date, blow up their email, blow up their cell phone, and just remind them how important it was that if they were going to support it all, please do it in the first 24 hours, because then once you're on the homepage, or at least you're a featured or favorite project in a category, so like food and beverage for me.
Yeah. And you mentioned reaching out to people that were successful before. One, I think that could be intimidating to a lot of people to be like, I don't know them. Are they even going to respond? So you broke through that barrier, but how did you get them to respond?
Yeah, a couple different things. So one, life is sales. And if you don't have any sales experience, I highly recommend you try selling for a little bit, because being a CEO is going to require a lot of selling. You cannot fear rejection. Rejection is a massive part of the process. You're going to fail more than you win. So you're going to have to swing the bat a lot, because it's all about getting a certain amount of points on the scoreboard. Good news, you get unlimited at-bats. There's a lot of people in the world you can email. There's a lot of people in the world you can send a cold LinkedIn message to. And there's a lot of people in the world that, you know, you can ask. A rule that I always had when I was applying for jobs and trying to break into previous industries, which is a corollary to this, is if someone can't help introduce me or like get me an interview or get me further down the process, I always at the end of every conversation said, and is there anyone else you think I should talk to? And so essentially, if this person isn't helping propel you further in the direction of, let me introduce you to this supplier, let me, you know, I'll be a customer, I'll buy the product, or I'm interested, sign me up for a demo, different industry, but you know, that's something you're trying to go for sometimes. That's a win if they can prospect for you, if they can introduce someone else that might be a better fit for you. So I try to end every conversation with anyone with, thank you so much for your time. By any chance, is there anyone else you think I should talk to? Is there anyone else that's done a Kickstarter before, likes barbecue, has built a business on the internet? But just ask for referrals, and a tumbleweed and a snowball effect will occur. And people like helping other people. You'd be surprised. So you're right. You're going to get a low response rate. Many people won't even respond to your email. You're going to nudge them 2, 3, 4 times, cold turkey. But the people that you do connect, you need to know how to utilize them. and actually harvest it into more leads, more people, more conversations. So I was fortunate enough to know someone that was part of ButcherBox, and that one was already in my network. The rest, I had to drum up and find myself. And there's different ways to go at it. You know, I swam, I went to a college. I always said, like, I didn't go to Bates College. I was a college swimmer. Did you swim at any school in the world? I'll reach out to you saying, hey, noticed you swam at Texas Tech. I swam at Bates College. Anyways, next sentence. Just find some sort of overlap with someone to make them a friend. I'm not a college alumni. I'm an athletic conference alumni. Hey, notice you went to a NESCAC college. I went to a NESCAC college. Make your network bigger than it is. Don't do the typical, it's the school you went to, it's the town you're from, it's this or that. Notice you're from the Chicagoland area. Me too. That's a 10 million person network right there. Hey, I just moved to New York. I notice you live in New York. Find a very little sliver of overlap, and it creates a little bit of comfort, and people get like tricked into, I have something in common with this person, even though I said something fairly generic and wide open. And I think that was one of the secret sauces, or one of my secret sauces to networking. So I'll kind of throw that in there as well.
I love that. And the referral at the end of any conversation, because you never know who people know or how they're thinking through what you're talking about, and making it open-ended. I think that's a great move. One other thing is, as you're launching people to the splash page or getting people to the splash page, what are you doing to pull that off? Because I'm assuming you're not sitting on a bunch of dry powder to just throw at Facebook ad.
Correct. So the splash page was how I was essentially monetizing my existing network and those referrals. So I luckily had worked for, you know, 10 years. I was already active on all these different social media platforms. By no means am I an influencer or something. I had, you know, maybe 1,000 or 800 Instagram followers and, you know, 1,000 Facebook friends. But you're going to, 30 days out, start spamming that as a status and a post at least once a day. And on those phone calls, similar to what I said, you're going to be asking for referrals. And like, your true inner circle, your, you know, your family, your friends, you're not only going to say, can you support the page? You're going to say, can you make a status about this too? And it's going to be, hey, my friend is my best friend. Hey, my brother. Oh, my favorite cousin is starting the world's best barbecue company. You guys should check this out. And you need to activate your network to be doing these referrals for you. And it's hard. Like, some people are going to be uncomfortable doing it. Pre-write the statuses for them. This is the family member one. This is the friend one. This is the classmate. This is the colleague. Yeah. Hey, we worked together for 3 years. I'd really appreciate if you told your colleagues about it. If you're uncomfortable explaining it to them, I've written the message for you. I've written the copy and paste.
Yeah.
And, you know, you got to activate your network to become your biggest advocates. And through that, you can turn, you know, your 1,000 people, if they all have 500 or 1,000 people, next thing you know, the math quickly becomes a network of 100,000 people. I only got a couple hundred supporters, but you need to activate many people to be enthusiastic about it.
That's so good. And it's so intimidating to be like, okay, yeah, I want to share this about Andrew, but what do I write? If you can remove any point of friction to make it easy for them, it's like, go for it. So I like the idea of pre-writing the copy so they kind of don't have an excuse. It's like, hey, it's right there for you. All right, so you launch. It's a success. It's a wild success. You're sitting on all this cash and people that want some barbecue, or they want to see you make some barbecue. What's next? You're like, wait a minute, I might have a business here.
Yeah, so the other advantage to doing Kickstarter as well, or any sort of crowdfunding where you're coming in with this momentum of money, then you can approach the ecosystem with a significantly higher level of seriousness. So it's much easier when you go to a contract manufacturer or a distributor and say, hey, I'm thinking about making this business. What do you have in this, that, versus saying, hey, I ran a campaign online. I've got 600 people that want half slabs of ribs delivered to their door. I've got 30 grand in the bank. I'm looking to get this done. Can you help? People are going to take you so much more seriously. So that's the other huge win with doing anything like this, because it's not, hey, I went to a bunch of investors and I have money. It's, hey, I went to the customers. They already gave me their money. This is the product I promised and we're making. We need to execute this. I had taken a lot of those meetings in advance to the Kickstarter, so I already understood the cost structure and things of that nature. So I knew how to price it on the Kickstarter, and I knew where this thing was going to shake out. But when you're then ready to actually start signing the documents and executing things, people are much more excited to work with you. They treat you as a real customer rather than a prospective customer that might flame out in 6 months. It's the snowball effect. You're already in the game. You're already a player. You're not an aspiring team member or spot. You're not trying out for the team. You came to ball. You transferred. You've been playing. So once we had the money, it was calling all these people up and saying, "Hey, green light." Like they knew about the Kickstarter as well. It was, "Hey, green light. Can you send the documents? We're ready to sign." "Hey, green light. We're ready to, you know, we're ready to onboard." "Hey, green light. We're ready to get this done." And there were really two key players in that. One was the contract manufacturer. So someone that could cook, you know, ribs at scale. This isn't me in my backyard making 6 half slabs at a time. This is, you know, at current state, I need to make 1,000 at a time. So commercial kitchen, people that know how to operate that type of equipment. And then Two, the fulfillment center, where we then ultimately move those products and they divvy it up. So it's send Jim 3, send Andrew 5, send Bob 10. All those people were excited, eager to onboard and getting those wheels turning. And actually, I think I was unique in doing all that pre-homework, because many Kickstarters, you don't get your product for 6 to 12 months. My Kickstarter ended and everyone got their product 5 weeks later. And partly because they don't give you the money for a month. So I waited. I everything was teed up. The second we got the money, everyone got their stuff shipped within a week. So I thought that was pretty cool that we did that. And a lot of people that supported us that had supported other Kickstarters in the past said, "I was not expecting it this fast. How did you do that?"
Yeah, it's like, "I actually got my product. This is amazing." So you Kickstarter is a success. You're off to the races. You have the first customers, your early adopters. I mean, we can kind of talk to the scale that you're at, but I'm so interested in growth at these different inflection points. Like, you clearly validated it. Talk through that next phase of when this starts to become a real business and how you start to get to 6 figures.
Sure. So the Kickstarter hits, you think all the hard work's done. You're like, "Cool, I already have all these customers and it's working. And in a week, they're all going to give me 5-star reviews and everyone's going to be happy." It doesn't go like that. You sell your orders, the website goes live, and then you're like, "Where are all the new customers? This is very slow and no one's coming to the website. What are we going to do?" And so I did not take a full digital approach. I said, "It's food. People got to try it. You know, there's people that go to Costco just to eat the free samples. Let's do that." And so I went around New York City and I found sports bars that do not serve food or don't have kitchens. So all they had is like, "Do you want a bag of potato chips or popcorn?" And I said, "Hey, I'm assuming that people leave after 2 or 3 hours because they're hungry. Can I set up a grill out front and sell ribs? It'll keep customers at your bar longer and it might even attract a few new ones. I'll also promote it on social media and, you know, I'll gain my own little group of followers that are now going to come to these bars because they won't eat my ribs." And that was oddly a very easy value prop. "We don't sell this product and it'll keep people here longer, right? Potentially bring new ones in, and you're going to take up no real estate. So you're going to do it on the sidewalk right out in front. Works for us." So we started doing pop-ups in New York City. And that was where most of the money came from after the Kickstarter. It was like, do the pop-ups to afford to learn how to do digital marketing. So I'd go in person and, you know, make money at the pop-up to then blow it all on Facebook, to then blow it all on Google, and to learn digital marketing. And digital marketing's hard. I mean, the initial thesis, I said urban smokehouse, it's in the name. I thought I was bringing barbecue to the city. I thought it was, "Hey, there's a lot of apartments and condos and these people don't have grills. They definitely don't have smokers. There's maybe a communal grill on the roof. They don't want to cook for 5 to 12 hours, the amount of time it takes to smoke meat. They probably want to make dinner in 15 minutes. This might be a young professional." That was the initial thesis. So then you start marketing on Facebook and you can kind of attack different groups, you know, old people, young people, men, women, these interests, those interests, these zip codes, these geographies. And my initial thesis was completely wrong. I didn't know my customer. My customer is old people in retirement states. They live in Florida. They live in New Mexico. They live in Arizona. They live in Georgia. They're retired. That was not young people in cities. And so I was spending all my marketing dollars incorrectly, but you kind of set up a bunch of different campaigns and you do what I call feed your winners, trim your losers. These ads are working. Spend more on those. These ones aren't. Scale down or turn them off. It takes time. You're going to lose a lot of money in the beginning. And then eventually you're going to say, Now I have a sense of what my customer looks like. And also, meanwhile, in the background, more people come to the website, more people write reviews, more people talk positively about it on social media. The snowball occurs. But in order to accelerate the snowball, you need to constantly acquire new customers as well into the ecosystem. And so we probably spent 6 to 8 months losing money or in break-even territory where I was living off savings and depleting all the money we'd make from the pop-up every week. And then it started clicking, and customer acquisition costs went down. Our return on ad spend went up, and we started making good money. And also throughout this entire process, you're going to be tweaking your menu and your pricing, because you're going to realize my product's too cheap. There's two options. I have to get better at advertising, or my product's too cheap. But like, this margin isn't working. Will they tolerate higher prices? Can I get better at marketing? These are questions you're going to be asking yourself the entire time, and likely going to iterate on constantly. And we got to a place probably after 6 months where it started becoming good on the internet. And I no longer had to do the pop-ups, because we were making, you know, more than the pop-up money every day on the internet. And so I focused exclusively on the internet. And then we added another product, and that improved our average order value, which makes things, you know, even juicier. And we kind of tweaked how we presented things on the website and learned how to play the AOV game. And slowly but surely you get better. And it's hard, because every few months, you know, the algorithm will change or something weird happens and you got to relearn something. But digital marketing is not stagnant. It's very much just something you need to watch at all times, and you'll be turning things on and off. And I did not know that going in. And that was a big key learning, because it's 80% of the business.
I want to get into the AOV and the business model, but one kind of call out, the Vita CEO, Jensen, he just did this amazing quote at Stanford MBA around how people need to be more resilient and how suffering is actually a superpower. It was this epic quote. And one thing that you mentioned is like, you're doing this really cool arbitrage of making money offline to invest in online, because you know that's how the business scales, is if you get online working. But you're in this trough of sorrow or this phase where it's really hard, it's not working. Like, what's your mental state as you have one of those days where like, well, I just sunk all of our profits into a campaign with young people and it's not working?
It is hard. And I agree with the quote that you started this with. I think a lot of life's staying power. A lot of people quit too early. And there's a couple different iterations of it, but I've seen this as a quote from a couple different well-known CEOs and executives and things of that nature. And it's staying power. It really is. Because there's so much learning in messing up. And if you completely go a different direction, you're actually resetting. Or if you go the W-2 route and go work for someone else, maybe you're getting training wheels, but you're learning through those mistakes. You're learning through messing it up. You're learning how to make it work. But to be frank, I mean, there were many nights where I had a very hard time going to sleep, seeing that I spent, you know, $1,000 on ads and generated, I don't know, $200 in sales, just knowing I'm bleeding money on the internet. And that doesn't even cover, you know, the cost of fulfilling the product and the cost of the actual. So you're just like, is this going to work? Like, crap, what is going on? But then you have your good days where you're excited and you're like, oh my God, like, it's working now. And then it breaks again 2 days later. But it's that slow iteration where it slowly gets better. And it still happens. I mean, I this is very young. I'm, you know, approaching 2 years into this and in about 2 months. So we're, you know, 10 months in. And I mean, there still are bad days. There still are bad weeks. But, you know, it's about having that above 500 batting average. It's about having more wins than losses. And you learn and you iterate on it. I agree. I don't know what to tell you other than it is staying power. It's brutal in the beginning. Know that going in. My dad used to say, when you're planning a vacation, budget it and then double it. That's what it actually is going to cost. And that's true for business as well. And I do that for time frames as well. However long you think it's going to take and however much money you think it's going to take, double both of those estimates. That's more realistic. You got to be ready for a lot.
I love that. Yeah, it's going to be harder, take longer, be more expensive, but then it'll hopefully be like more fulfilling and rewarding. And that's a good quote. I might steal that and tell it to my girls, especially when they try and hit me up for money. So you get it working. You're open-minded to switch to the persona that's working. You're digging into that. I want to nerd out on business model a little bit because you hit on something where you're like, hey, we figured out the right average order value. So for the AOV, so for people listening, I think you and I spoke initially, the average order values, you know, around 160. And a lot of people that if you're running a company, it's like, okay, why is it important to have a high AOV? Obviously, it's because you can spend more to acquire customers, have better margins, reinvest in profit, because usually companies are earmarking 30 to 33% of what they make on a product for acquisition costs if you're doing ads. How did you settle on the right AOV? What did you do, whether it's like bundling or different like tactics to raise the AOV or just to get a business model that works with paid ads? Because I don't think people talk about that enough. It's like, you can have a great business, but does it work for running paid ads?
Totally. And there's so many levers there, and there's a lot of levers we pulled as time passed. But I'd say this. So when the business started, actually before even starting the business, I studied other people that do mail order food online. And I put a big focus on not new high flying venture backed guys. I wanted to study people that have been doing it for 30 plus years, preferably actually 100 years. I did it before the internet. So I looked at, for example, Omaha Steaks, third generation family business. They've been selling steak on the internet since the internet's been a thing. So they probably know how to price things. They probably know how to advertise. They probably have done the model correctly, and they don't have a bunch of imaginary VC money where they're spending more saying it'll work in 5 years, just keep spending. No, they're profitable. Same with Honey Baked Ham. Same with a couple other guys that I knew had been selling food on the internet, which I'll call since inception. And so I went to their websites and I said, how do they price things? What are the incentives? What are the hurdles? And you'll notice on a lot of these guys' websites, there's a couple tricks to get you to spend at least $130 or $150 on their website. And one would be, yeah, there might be items on the website that are 10 bucks. You can't check out until you hit a minimum order value. So be like, oh yeah, you can add an item to your cart that's 10 bucks, but we're not going to ship you anything unless you spend at least $65 or $70. So you put those items in your cart, like, okay, now I can check out. And say, like, oh, well, actually, if you want to unlock free shipping, you know, there's a couple more dollars you got to spend. So next thing you know, if you go on either of those websites, you'll notice you're highly incentivized and you likely won't leave the website unless you spend mid $100. And those were their two gating mechanisms to get you there. And there are other things too on the website that incentivize you to spend more money. If you're similar to anywhere, if you buy in bulk, you get more off. So, you know, every steak you add, the cost of the steak goes down. Every pack of ribs you add, the cost of the ribs goes down. They might also be doing like seasonal or holiday specials. So, you know, shouting out an event, 4th of July, Easter, NCAA March Madness, whatever it is, there's probably some sort of special. But I noticed that. So when I started my business, I also view free shipping as table stakes online right now. So it's like, we can't charge for shipping. Like, we need to have free shipping. But if you do the math, I'm selling you an item that needs to come to you quickly because it's frozen and there's ice in the box. It's going to melt. It's going to thaw. It's going to go bad. So I'm already forced to ship it fast. Second, it's heavy. It's ice and meat. That's heavy. So like free shipping, I'm giving you a lot with free shipping. And so as I started looking at the math, it was like, I would literally have to charge you $70 for one serving in order to make any money, which is an egregious cost. That's like, you know, an extreme multiple of what it costs in the grocery store. So I'm forced to sell baskets. I'm forced to sell at least four servings. And even at four servings, I can't give you a great price per unit. The good prices per unit start at 6 and 8 units. So I said, okay, let's start with we're obviously not going to do a 1, 2, or 3 pack. We're going to start with at least 4 units and sell that. So I put that on the website. Next thing you know, all of the comments and the ads are people complaining like, what's the cost per unit? It's like, they got to buy more units, guys. I can't have these negative comments on my ads. We've got to kill the smaller baskets so that people aren't talking poorly about the pricing. But the thing they don't realize is, it's because I'm giving you free shipping of expedited rates with dry ice in it. So it's the same to me, but you kind of quickly realize like, dang, average order value matters a lot, especially for me because my item's heavy and needs to move fast. But I'm giving you free shipping. It's everything. And so that was what that initially began all the conversations of, all right, we need to tweak pricing. All right, we need to tweak the offerings. Like we at one point had a 2-pack, because every once in a while I'll still see on my comments someone being like, I live by myself. Like, I don't want to buy 4. I don't want to buy 6. And we always say, like, put it in your freezer. And they're like, I just want to try just one. And I always respond, like, if I showed you the price for just one, you wouldn't want to, because adding another one costs basically nothing to just one. Masking that shipping cost is the burden. And so that's why AOV became such a big thing to us. And so we started just really targeting our ads and really targeting our basket sizes. So you're highly incentivized to buy more units. And that was also what was huge about once we ultimately added a second product, because we only started with one SKU, it was just ribs. We added a second product, we had bundling and second products. It really improved our AOV. So our AOV probably started a little over $100, like 108, 109, which it was hard. The business didn't work there. And then we started convincing people to spend $130 with just better pricing through the more you buy, the more you save. And then when we launched that second product, brisket, that's when our AOV started pushing 150 plus. And we just added chicken. Mm-hmm. The AOVs haven't gone up much more, but it's having the second product and just really focusing on pricing advantages for improved basket sizes got us there. And it's better value for the customer. They get a way better per unit cost. And it matters to us just because we have to mask that shipping cost to make the unit prices attractive. So that's our kind of our AOV journey.
Yeah, yeah. No, and it makes sense. And then it's such a big lever to pull, but doing experiments on pricing in real time can always be tough because people have opinions, people are jumping in. And so, yeah, navigating the commenters or the spammers is one thing. Can you speak at all to like the size of the business where it's at? Because I think it's worth noting what you've done in a short time frame is really impressive. Like, where do you all sit today? And I'm interested to hear what's the goal here?
Last year around this time, we were doing 30,000 a month. Now we're doing about $250,000 a month. And the goal this year is to have a month where we do $1 million. So our goal. So last year, I say we 10x'd, or you know, in terms of monthly revenue. The goal this year is to get 2 doubles. So if we 2x twice, we'll be happy. You know, there's a lot of learnings as well in the first year, because you learn not only who your customer is, but is there seasonality in the business? What is the value prop? When do I need to discount products? How often should I do that? What makes sense to people? Do people like offers where they get, do people like buy one, get one free? Do people like seeing dollars off? Do people like seeing percentage off? You know, there's a lot of different ways to offer promotion, and figuring out what type of promotions resonate with your customers is also part of the learning curve. But our goal is, yeah, if we get to $1 million a month this year, we'll be happy. And once we hit that, I think we're going to actually consider putting some of these products in retail as well. It's like in grocery stores. One of our big theses is owning the customer relationship's huge. And you don't do that in food and bev by going through retail. So if this product was on the shelves of Kroger's or Whole Foods or Costco, at the end of the day, I just know people at Costco buy this product. I don't know it's old women in Illinois and young men in Florida and middle-aged guys in California and nobody in the state of Maine. And knowing that and having their emails and their phone numbers is huge. And so I believe that ultimately, once we hit what I'll call critical mass, I'm going to be able to approach retailers pretty easily and say, hey, I pulled up the map of Whole Foods. Out of your 3,000 stores, 2,900 of them have at least 10 of my active customers living in a 10-mile radius. Those customers in aggregate gave this a 4.84 out of 5 stars. I have their direct email and phone number. If you put it on the shelves, I can contact them immediately and say, go pick this up at your local Whole Foods. That should give you confidence in placing my product on your shelf versus anyone that goes retail first, because they don't know their customer as well as me. So I think there's a data play growing online first, and that's a thesis we're working on. Yeah. Well, and right now we just do Shopify. We are in the very final rounds of launching on Amazon as well. So we'll be available on Amazon as well here.
Oh, very cool. I want to take a second. We should take a victory lap, or you should take a victory lap. Going from $30,000 a month to basically $250,000 a month, and this is all on the back of being black belt at paid acquisition on Facebook and Instagram. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'd say 95% of our marketing budget's Meta. The rest is Google and very, very, very little TikTok. So that's another thing we did too in the beginning. In addition to learning your customer, we had to learn we had to learn digital marketing. So I just spent on every platform equally. And then I was like, Facebook works.
Yeah.
These other ones don't. Stopping all spending. Facebook's my guy. And then you as you get further down, you go, okay, let's reapproach this. Let's learn. Let's have experimental dollars now that we have more like play money. Because we want to learn all the platforms. And the game, problem with digital marketing is it's a forever changing animal. So you can, it's not a set it and forget it. You will always be studying this. There will always be a new platform. You need to learn the new platform, the new science, the new method. You know, you need to learn short form video. You need to learn this. You need to learn that. So being a student of the game and spending a little bit everywhere is important, I think. But knowing what works and spending the most there is yeah. how you make money. And hopefully those other things will scale and eventually become just as successful as Facebook.
That's amazing. And what advice would you give to people that are looking to grow a D2C brand on the back of Meta? Like, as far as like designing an ad, like what ad, and talking, we won't get into account structure. Let's just talk about like ad creative. Like what has worked for you all, or what advice would you give to people? Because creative is such a key part, or even just positioning and copy and persuasion is so crucial. What advice would you give?
Try everything and iterate. It's part of the experimentation. I mean, I wasn't using any AI tools, you know, a year ago. Now, I mean, some of my ads are literally entirely generated by AI. There's AI videos, there's AI stagnants, because you can type in funny things. So I'll like, you know, around Christmas, I'll like, you know, play around and eventually get an image of like the Grinch stealing ribs from someone. And like, we're not filming that. It's, you know, just made through a software tool, but it's like a funny, catchy image. And that will be a Christmas ad and it'll work. And we'll do the same thing for other holidays. And, you know, just things where you can be like funny and playful. But you know, a year ago, we didn't do any of that. And how we initially caught our success is I basically once a month had someone come over to my house and we would film for 4 or 5 hours, just 100 different random, I'll call it TikTok style hooks, or me saying a value prop or something funny or catchy in 1 to 2 sentences. And each month had a different theme. And I built this massive content library. So I have probably over 3,000 videos now with me in it, where it's like 100 of me doing something in a Santa hat, 100 of me doing something in a basketball jersey at a basketball court, 100 of me cooking, you know, 100 of me wearing a bunch of American paraphernalia on 4th of July, you know, and a bunch of these different scenarios. And so we built this massive library of some of them are serious hooks. Some of them are comedic. Some of them are me reading the best comments or reviews we've gotten online. Some of them are me reading the worst comments or reviews we've gotten online and responding to them. But it's honestly, sadly, a spray and pray game. It's an A-B testing game. It's a try a lot of things, do what works, stop what isn't, and then keep experimenting on the side, because this is going to stop working soon. There's ad fatigue. Everything stops eventually. Yeah. Everything dies eventually. Everything slows down and has a decreasing return on ad spend eventually. So you need to be constantly finding that next thing that's going to run like wildfire for a little bit. And so we iterate, and I try to make it formulaic. So those content shoots, then I use like virtual assistants abroad to help edit those videos. And so mass filming session, 2 weeks later, I have 100 videos that I can post. Mass filming session, 2 weeks later, I have 100 videos I can post. Do that once a month. And then in addition, now there's just a ton of playful things you can do with AI, both in terms of video and still ads. And then we also do run still ads or image ads as well. That, like, I always believe in too, that I like shouting out like our best reviews. So I'll do like a collage of like 30 really high quality reviews we've gotten, or like 30 great Facebook comments we've gotten. You know, thank you emails. People that jumps off the page of people, and it makes it tangible because it's a real name. It's less of an ad. So that's some of the stuff that's worked for us. But I can't iterate enough. Digital marketing is not stagnant. It is not set it and forget it. It is a living, breathing thing that you need to nurture constantly and iterate on constantly.
So true. Some people, you just want to be able to like set it up, let it run and let it cook. But yeah, their algorithm changes all the time. You got to be up to speed on it. So totally agree. Well, last two questions I have. One is, I mean, if you were starting today all over again, or giving advice to somebody starting, what advice would you give them if they're about to go down this path?
Two things. One, the most helpful people to talk to in advance isn't your immediate network. It's, you want to find people that have done it before and reach out to them. So for me, that was just e-com in general, and then like food and beverage. and then the ecosystem that that plays in. So like the best advice I got, the best nuggets of information I got was when I went to the distributor and I said, hey, I'm starting this business. Can you tell me the common attributes of everyone that signed up with you and failed within 6 months? And can you tell me the common attributes that everybody that signed up with you and is still working with you now for over 10 years? Very good information right there. Very good information. And that's not a call that's hard to get. That's a guy that you're actually going to start paying soon. He's about to be working with you. So yeah. He's invested in you as much as you are him. He doesn't want a failing person in his ecosystem. Same thing with the production. You know, anyone you're going to work with, just ask them, you know, who are your winners and who are your losers and what do they look like? Because you're about to become one of his winners or losers.
Yeah.
So that was the best nuggets came from that. And for me, it's different if you're going to be doing Amazon FBA, but if you're going to do branded products like me, the guy told me most of the people that come in and try to sell a million products right away fail. It's the people that do a targeted approach that win. And I launched with one product, and I really credit that to a lot of my success because he told me about so many guys that come in with, you know, big diversified menu, which I want to grow into, but they start with the big diversified menu and five items sell amazing and 80 of them rot in the warehouse and go bad and are terrible and 15 are mediocre. And then even though you had success, all of the non-success killed your success. So I think that was important too. And the sage sentence for it is, you know, take the sniper rifle approach rather than the shotgun. Or, take the targeted approach rather than the spray and pray, which is the opposite for digital marketing. For digital marketing, you try everything and then you feed the winners and cut the losers. But the physical products, we can't afford to try things that we don't want to keep doing. So I'd leave it as that, as the best piece of advice.
And that's really good, man. And what a great prompt to give someone that has deep industry expertise too. And then the last one, what's the nicest thing anyone's done for you in your professional career?
It actually was at the very beginning. So on our Kickstarter, there were a couple different tiers we had. I think the lowest tier was like $25 or $30 to get a t-shirt. In between that, it was like buying ribs or just buying the product. And then we had like a crazy tier. The craziest tier was $5,000. We'd like fly out to you and do like a barbecue for, I don't know, you and your family or you and your friends. Someone actually bought that tier. And then they responded, I don't want a barbecue. Where do you live? Just go feed as many homeless people as you can at the local homeless shelter for that money. I was like,
oh, wow.
Whoever you are a goat. Thank you. I appreciate you so much. And like the fact that then you turn this into a double like local gift is so cool. And yeah, that I thought that was pretty cool.
So that's just a random person on the internet that dropped $5,000
for that. Yeah, there were two people that bought that package. One person actually claimed the cookout of the barbecue and the other person donated to the local homeless shelter here in New York.
Oh man, that's amazing. That's a good story. Well, cool, man. Well, I'm excited to watch and see this thing continue to grow. The success has been amazing over the past few years. So well done. So if people want to follow you, Urban Smokehouse, or get some ribs, not one rib, but let's order a bunch of people. The shipping is very real. Where should we send them?
The website is urbansmokehouse.co, so .co, not .com. And that website, urbansmokehouse.co, is also our handle on all social media. So you can find us on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, YouTube with that handle as well. And that's the best way to reach out to us. If you want to email support@urbansmokehouse.co, I check the support email. So if you're trying to reach out to me too, it's the best way to get a hold of me as well right now. But I always love coming on the show. I love talking entrepreneurship and small business. Hopefully this can help some of you guys accomplish your goals and worst case, eat some tasty ribs.
Awesome. Boy, Andrew, thank you so much for the time.
Thanks, Jim.
I'll give a few plugs. First, I send a weekly newsletter each Thursday featuring 5 articles or tools that have helped me. You can sign up for these weekly updates at jimwhuffman.com. Second, for anyone running a startup, if you need help growing your business, check out Growth Hit. Growth Hit serves as your external growth team. After working with over 100 startups and generating $250 million in sales for clients, Growth Hit has perfected a growth process that's hell-bent on driving ROI through rapid experiments. Plus, you'll get to work with yours truly. So if you want to work with a team that's worked with startups that have been funded by Andreessen Horowitz or featured on Shark Tank, then check out growthhit.com. And finally, I wrote a book called The Growth Marketer's Playbook that takes everything I've learned as a growth mentor for venture-backed startups, and I've distilled it down to 140 pages. So instead of hiring a growth team, save yourself some money, get the book, and you can just do it yourself. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I'd love to hear feedback. I'm on Twitter at Jim W. Huffman.
Are you a business owner in desperate need of talent, but you have issues finding good people? Or worse, you find the talent, but then they want you to pay them double what you have budgeted. Yeah, I know the feeling. This is where Remotely Talents can help. Imagine having a personal HR team that finds you A-plus talent, and here's the best part. It costs you 40 or even 80% less than US employees. It's magic. So let's say you need help with setting up your social ads, your Google ads, email marketing, website development, customer service. Their team sources the top Ukrainian talent for you, and they deliver three top vetted candidates straight to your inbox. It's a one-time payment, and best yet, they give you a 60-day guarantee to ensure you're happy. Hey, if it doesn't work out, they'll find and replace the talent for free. Even better, 3% of all sales go to the Children's Hospital in Ukraine. At Growth Head, our agency, we've hired 4 people from Ukraine. I am blown away by the level of work we're getting. So whether you need a virtual assistant or a creative director, give this a try. Go to remotelytalents.com right now and start a conversation. See if they can help you. You really have nothing to lose.